This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann, and I am joined today by our roving reporter, Tim Lynch. If I keep saying that, it'll stick.
It'll stick eventually, yeah.
Tell us what you're up to, Tim.
Right, what am I up to? Well, I've been having really interesting conversations with activists and protesters. And this is part of my doctoral research, which is framed around the notion of communication of climate change, more specifically within the culinary and education field. But to try and frame some of that, I needed to figure out where I stand on this bell curve of activism, if you want, and where I sit. And is what I'm doing actually effectual? And so to start sort of framing and putting myself within that paradigm, I decided I'd go to the extremities of it, which in this case would be the conversation we're about to listen to is one that I had with Rosemary. Who's a really fascinating person, a really interesting person. I walked away with many, many thoughts that we'll come back to at the end of this. But we'll let Rosemary take over. She can introduce herself.
I grew up daughter, child number five in a family of seven on a small farm near Whanganui. Pretty wild and free. By the time you get to number five, you're not too careful about the rules, although... Yeah, it was a wonderful childhood. I was very lucky. My first act of civil disobedience was probably when I figured out that Dad had put my pet calf in the freezer. So I stopped eating meat for some time. And in those days, you know, a child would die if it didn't have meat. So that was quite effective. I didn't keep not eating meat. I had a teacher. I went to a very small country school. There were two of us in my year. And she was my second cousin. But the teacher, Mr. Taylor, I'm going to name him. When I think back, he taught me to question authority. Which, you know, has got me into a bit of trouble over the years. But, yeah, I'm really grateful for that. No, it was sparked by my dad and my teacher, the same teacher, who would occasionally come to my house in the evening and I'd sneak around listening through the doorway as my father, really mild-mannered man, was thumping the table about we should not be there. And I figured out it was Vietnam and there was a war going on and what were we doing. And so that actually sparked my own... What's happening in the world? There's a lot I don't know, and I'm out. So interesting, eh? I was probably about 13 or so. I'm sure lots of kids, things like that. Yeah, but I mean, I wouldn't say right from the start. I was a really ordinary kid, and I am just a very ordinary person. And I was very shy when I was young, so I've had to really work on that. There's no sign of it anymore because there's no time for it. Yeah.
We've had Rosemary on the show a few years ago. I'm pretty sure she described herself as a grandmother activist.
What's her notion of activism and activist?
Yeah, it's funny because you think about the word activist, it's pretty loaded. It's like it's got a real weight behind it. And I think for a lot of people, you know, they may not actually want to have those connotations associated with them. They may not want to be put under this umbrella of activism. So the question that I asked Rosemary is like about the word activist. You know, what how does she feel about the word activist? And was there a particular event that triggered her into activism?
I think it's a silly word. I don't think we've got a much better one. We're all active. I don't mind using it. It's not a big thing in the scheme of what's important. In the climate movement, yes, it was 2011. And three things happened. One, two, three. Jeanette Fitzsimons, who you're sure you know of, was visiting Dunedin, talking about Mataura Valley being dug up for lignite coal. At that point, Solid Energy had already bought up most of the farms in an area. And it was not the facts and figures, which she was very good at spouting. It was what she said at the very end of her talk, which was, I will be doing this for the rest of my life. And it just hit me very physically, right in there. And I knew from that day on, it's also what I'd be doing. So I got into that campaign. James Hansen had also come to Dunedin that year, I think. He might have been the first. And I didn't understand his forcings and his tipping points and things, but I've been working on that. But what I understood was this man really, even then, was the giant of climate science. He was terrified. Then my grandson was born, and I was at his birth. And I wasn't prepared for what I'd feel about him and where we were at in civilizational decline. And what he, in his lifetime, will go through. He will be 39 in 2050. So that really was a big kick in the bum. And until then, I was, you know, there was this really scary thing that I wouldn't look at because life was too busy. And I was working as a medical laboratory scientist, and it was a busy time and a lot of overtime, a lot of night shift. You'll understand that as a chef. It's hard to think of anything else. But I started really organising my life so that I could put my energy in the most important that I felt I could. I think the whole collective thinking is what's missing. We've stopped. We've been taught. We've been schooled to think as individuals. And we will not get any until we stop that way of thinking. Yeah, I also feel I was very privileged in my career as a medical lab scientist to be the union rep and to experience how people, when they work collectively, can actually change.
Rosemary has clearly moved beyond that, just to the left. I'm imagining it just to the left of the peak of the bell curve, further on to that more extreme activist side. How does she describe that progression?
Yeah, and that's right, because that notion of, like, you know, direct action. And like last week we were talking about Andreas Malm and the necessity that he claims for the need to have direct action, to have those, you know, quote-unquote violent interventions. And last week Kyle talked about what is violence. And so these things change over time. And so I did actually have to ask Rosemary, it's like, you know, has her approach to the way she views or undertakes activism changed? Because she's not a young pup. Most people at Rosemary's age at best would be playing golf.
I think I've just become more comfortable with civil disobedience. I think I've become more sure that as the years tick by, as the weeks tick by, and the state of the world and the time we've got left to actually make change becomes more urgent, then I feel the need for revolution more urgently. And I don't pretend to know any answers. I don't pretend to know any answers. But I'm less prepared to hold back. I'm less prepared to wait and see. I'm less prepared to go and do the thing I love, which is being out in the garden and chopping down gorse. And I find it really harder and harder to pretend that everything's okay. It's not. I think you could go right back to when I was 8 years old and my calf got put in the freezer, and I saw, okay, what could I do as one little girl? And I think also, I think my union work was a huge learning curve, and it was scary as hell, but going through negotiations with employers, they had the power. We didn't have the power. We knew we had to keep our terms and conditions for this career path to even work, for the whole system to work. So there was a big incentive to fight. And all we had was our body. All we had was our collective will to say no. And that's the thing that I learned here, was that sometimes saying no is the most positive thing you can ever do. Yeah. So that was a really cool learning.
I think on that continuum that we talk about, there's a difference between we've been imagining that these angry people are at the far right, but not that sort of far right of this bell curve. But I think there's probably further, which is actual violence against people. And I don't think you've talked to anybody that's engaged in that.
No. And I think it's probably important to be clear about that, and that when I'm using the word violence, I'm talking about, I should probably, the word startling or acts which are confronting. We do tend to think of, like, the political polarities, as you say, as the far right. We tend to think of that as being this idea of that's where the violence occurs. But, you know, even if we look at these attempted assassinations of Donald Trump, it's still yet to come out from which side of the political spectrum those shooters came from. For myself, I can only guess that they came from the left, because from the right, they probably would have been on target. That's my view on it. But these actions... And I felt a little bad when I was asking Rosemary this, but I had to ask her, you know, does doing things, these like really confronting actions, like stopping traffic, inconveniencing people, pushing people out of their sort of daily routines, is it actually effective?
Yes.
Does it do anything?
It was effective. In that moment, it brought attention to the crisis. 10,000 people did not follow me into prison. So that part did not work. Yeah, and so there's been some rethinking. But I do believe that I think this is where the big argument is with sitting on the road. You're interrupting ordinary people's lives. And to me, that is actually an important aspect of what we have to do to get change. And that's, I'm not, that isn't something that a lot of my fellow activists that I've worked with for more than a decade, a lot more, they don't think that. They still don't see it, as far as I can tell. So what I think is, because here we are, 2024, 2023 was an anomaly as far as, let's just look at the ocean. It's an anomaly. It looks as though we might have reached a tipping point. 90% of the heat was being absorbed by. it looks as if the shin can't do that anymore. Oh my God, this is end game coming up. And so doing a little march down the street with a sign to say we want the government to look after the freshwater or something, anything. I mean, they're all great and they're all important, but it's not going to be enough. So I am at a point in my consciousness in my life where I'm ready to step up. I want to do something that is in line with the emergency we are facing. And I know people don't get that because they're not being told the emergency we're in. And they don't, unlike me, I don't know why exactly, but they don't go searching perhaps to the worst, biggest scenarios. Everybody's seeing the terrible floods and that massive tornado in the south of the USA, for example. That's on the news. But yeah, if we could connect dots, we would all be terrified. We would all be so terrified. This government would not be trying to push a fast track bill through. More oil and gas drilling. I mean, it's insane. The people in charge are the wrong people, and we need to change it.
So to kind of continue on from that, the next thing is, and I once again have to be kind of careful when asking these questions, is, you know, if she was able to talk to some of the examples of direct action. The reason you have to be careful, because these are active court cases. These are still very much in the public eye, and there is a very large section of society, right or not right, that would rather the likes of Rosemary's of the world are not getting a platform to be able to talk about direct action, civil disobedience, things like that.
Yes, I could.
Yeah, sure.
I am actually currently under arrest for submitting my hand to that Highway 1. That was the last big action I did.
That's
quite... What's that?
Submitting
my hand to the motorway between Wellington Airport and the city. That was to get attention to the urgency of the climate situation. And the demand was so easy. It was, let's restore passenger rail throughout the country so we don't have to fly much, so we can start turning this ship around. We can start reducing our emissions in transport, which is the fastest growing sectors. There are some people currently it's still going through actually, the sentencing, the conviction and sentencing, who stopped the coal train from carrying coal from Southland to Canterbury to the Fonterra dairy factory. Yeah, I'm not one of those who was arrested. Yes, so since 2013, I've been outside protesting at every petroleum conference up until 20. So I was at Sky City, I was in Wellington, I was in New Plymouth, and then finally, when the industry moved the conference to Queenstown, I was there too. And I was pretty sick of doing the same old thing outside the conference. And so I tried to think something a little bit creative to make a point. And so I wrote a letter pretending to be the movers and shakers of the oil industry in New Zealand to say, oh my goodness, our children are marching the streets, which was big then in 2019. The Secretary General has just said we have to change our business. With everything we do. And he's talking about petrol. We're going to postpone this conference until further notice. I had a couple of lines in it that obviously were a joke. Obviously were a joke. And I sent it off to the speakers of that conference the week before it started. Yeah, and I got arrested. When was it? It was 2020, right after COVID, right after I was living in the caravan with Derek here. Three big burly policemen arrived at my caravan and put me under arrest, took my laptop, my phone. And yeah, that was the beginning of my arrest. And 3.5 years later, I was found guilty of forgery. Sentenced to 125 hours, which I did. And I'm still doing it because I loved it so much. I've been making cups of tea and looking after old people centre back here. I think everyone saw it as a joke, and I didn't think twice about it. I heard nothing. I received nothing for like 8-9 months. Can't remember how many months. But I found out via Official Information Act requests that I know the person pushed the police to pursue it. They didn't need to, but I can see that they would have wanted to make an exam. They knew me probably had photographs of me, and they were not going to let a little girl get away with making fun of them like that. That's how I see it. Yeah, a lot of resources. And what I haven't found out is the cost of those resources. I'm really interested to that.
Let's have some music, Tim. What have you got?
I thought we'd carry on with this idea of the anarchist punk. So we've got an American band called Mannequin Pussy. And I think in a lot of ways this sums up some of the feelings and emotions that Rosemary's talking about.
You have this way.
So perhaps from one nailed thing to another, did you ask Rosemary about some examples of her direct action?
Yeah, I did. And I had to be careful about asking these, to be honest, because a lot of these are still active court cases. They're still very much going through the judicial system, and there are this idea of creating platforms for people to highlight their own personal views ethically is a little challenging. So, yes, I did. I did ask Rosemary, you know, examples of direct action and things that she had been part of.
Yes, I could. I am actually currently under arrest for submitting my hand to State Highway 1. That was the last big action I did.
That's quite a bold statement.
What's that?
Cementing your hand to the motorway.
Cementing my hand to the motorway between Wellington Airport and the city. That was to get attention to the urgency of the climate situation. And the demand was so easy. It was, let's restore passenger rail throughout the country so we don't have to fly so much, so we can start turning this ship around. We can start reducing our emissions in transport, which is the fastest growing of our sectors. There are some people currently it's still going through actually, the sentencing, the conviction and sentencing, who stopped the coal train from carrying coal from Southland to Canterbury to the Fonterra dairy factory. Yeah, I'm not one of those who was arrested. Yes, so since 2013, I've been outside protesting at every petroleum conference country up until 2019. So I was at Sky City, I was in Wellington, I was in New Plymouth, and then finally, when the industry moved the conference to Queenstown, I was there too. And I was pretty sick of doing the same old thing outside the conference. And so I tried to think of something a little bit creative to make a point. And so I wrote a letter pretending to be the movers and shakers of the oil industry in New Zealand to say, oh my goodness, our children are marching in the streets, which was big then in 2019. The Secretary General has just said we have to change our business. We have to change everything we do. And he's talking about petroleum. We're going to postpone this conference until further notice. And I had a couple of lines in it that obviously we're a joke. Obviously we're a joke. And I sent it off to the speakers of that conference the week before it started. Yeah, and I got arrested. When was it? It was 2020, right after COVID, right after lockdown. I was living in a caravan with Derek here. Three big burly policemen arrived at my caravan door and put me under arrest, took my laptop, my phone, and yeah, that was the beginning of my arrest. And 3.5 years later, I was found guilty of forgery and sentenced to 125 hours of community service, which I did, and I'm still doing it because I loved it so much. I've been making cups of tea and looking after old people in a daycare centre. I think everyone saw it as a joke, and I didn't think twice about it. I heard nothing. I received nothing for like 8-9 months. Well, I can't remember how many months, but I found out via Official Information Act requests that I know the person who pushed the police to pursue it. They didn't need to, but I can see that they would have wanted to make an example of me. They knew me probably, they probably had photographs of me, and they were not going to let a little grandma get away with making fun of them like that. That's how I see it. Yeah, a lot of resources. And what I haven't found out is the cost of those resources. I'm really interested to find that out.
Rosemary talked a lot about doing this for her grandchildren. What do you think is the role of those relationships in the decision to take action, particularly direct action?
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, those relationships, like all relationships, you know, they should be loving and supportive as they should be. That said, I can't imagine if I came home and I said to Catherine, my partner, dear, I won't see you for a couple of days. I'm going to Wellington to superglue myself to a building, to spray red paint over something, to smash a window of a politician's building. The notion of support there, of what I would be expecting from my partner in that, is something I hadn't even considered until I had these conversations. And it's something that comes up later on when we're talking with Jen. It's something that comes up in greater depth. For Rosemary to do what she does, to be part of something that she feels so passionately about, is and can't be done without the support of a very supportive, loving relationship with her partner and being surrounded by friends who are supportive and understand what it is that she's trying to achieve and see the value and worth in it. And I think that in of itself probably speaks more to the activist movement, I think, than the actual individual acts themselves.
Well, I've got a very supportive family. Yeah, a very supportive family. Yeah, and the ones who are not supportive, I just don't hear from very often these days. Yeah, and I honestly don't judge or blame ordinary people for where they're at. I grew up in a farming community. I'm not judgmental. And I know people are, and I think that it doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me. That letter I wrote to the speakers at the 2019 conference, it was an individual act. But you can't work as an individual. And we won't get anywhere as individuals. And so it's really important to find a group of people who are like-minded, and basically we are building up to, we're there to support each other, and we're there to make collective decisions and figuring out from history, from each other, the best way to go forward. It's my grandkids that give me the motivation. It's I burnout, I don't know. I don't exactly know what burnout is, but I know that I've had to step back this year and work in the garden and get strong physically, because I was showing signs of fatigue that it might be just age, but I don't think so. Yeah. So what I find emotionally stressful is doing nothing. I think you'd understand that. And I think that people doing things together, doing positive things together, takes away that emotional stress. And for me, the emotional stress is being a bystander, watching these crazy decisions being made, watching the world begin to blow up, not, you know, on the other side of the world right now. And it's important for me. I think mental health is about being involved, I guess being active, being an activist. You know, I can't remember the quote exactly, but it's something like, it's no measure of good health to be well adjusted to an extremely and a profoundly sick society. And that's how I feel. We're living in this crazy time. We're getting messages telling us to do the exact opposite to what we should be doing. And we're worrying about the mental health of our kids. They are the same ones. We should cherish the fact that they are finding it difficult to adjust. No, don't adjust. Join us, change the world. And I mean, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, we couldn't even bring up climate change in our main media discussions because people would poo-poo it. You know, we were trying to stop the oil drilling out in the Canterbury Basins and the Great South Basin, and we talked about oil spills and the damage to our way of life rather than the climate situation. We'd bring that up, but it wouldn't be the main thing. But people get it now. But I don't think we've adapted our responses and our activism enough. As things go by, I've come to see the importance of that there is no difference. Social justice, climate justice, climate action, colonialism, indigenous rights, the stuff they're doing, trying to gut the te tiriti at the moment. There is no difference. It is connected, and it's important that it's connected, and we have to be fighting for all of that.
So it's funny when you're having these conversations, and you know the notion of like. Which action do you think Rosemary has been the most effective? It's almost like asking them to choose, you know, what's your favourite child? It's a very difficult thing to do, and it's almost like a redundant question. But I think it's important because within there have been different strategies that Rosemary has taken to protest, to take direct action. And what I really want to know was how she felt that they had been the most effective and which ones had been the most effective and why she felt that she had been most effective. Because this goes back to this conversation we had last week with Kyle when he was talking, you know, some of the most effective protests are the ones that allow you to have the widest platform. You know, cutting down trees on One Tree Hill to get on the Home Show just so you're able to talk about what it is that you're unhappy with. In that case, it was colonization. So I thought it was actually, I had to ask Rosemary this, you know, what action was the most effective?
Maybe my letter. Yeah, there's a line in there which I was reminded about just the other day because the gas industry was boasting to their overseas buddies that this is how we stopped gas. This is how we kept gas flowing in New Zealand. We convinced the politicians that it was a good transition fuel. And there was something else. And I can't remember, but there's a line in my letter that says, we've fooled Megan Woods about gas being a transition fuel, but we can't fool our children. Something like that. I can't remember. But I think that was probably my highlight. But actually then sitting on State Highway 1 might be my highlight too. Yeah, that was amazing. And I know that lots of people didn't like that and you just wait, folks. See what's coming. The people in South Carolina have felt it. Lots of people in Auckland have felt that flooding. I also know we've got the answers. We need Mike Joy out there. We need Mike Joy out there running the place. We need We need Annette Sykes out there running the place. We need Mike Smith. We need the people who know the answers. We need the people who know how to grow food, like my partner Derek, growing local food so that we don't all starve because the supply chains, in not too long a time, we're going to find, okay, we're already running out of olive oil, right? This is going to keep happening. We need to be able to feed ourselves. We don't need to be able to export coal-fired milk powder around the world. And so we've got two really big jobs. We've got to stop them somehow, as fast as possible. And it's not just the politicians. We've got to stop the warmongers. We need peace because humans don't want war. Humans deep down don't want war. And humans deep down want to live. And they want to care for each other. And they want to love each other. And it sounds ridiculous, I know. But that's where we have to go. At the moment, we've been trained, I don't know what we've been trained, to become little consumers with no heart. So yeah, it's not hope, it's determination to survive. And I know their life is never going to be like mine. It's already a different earth. It's already a different world. They have to be tougher. They have to be way tougher than I was. There is no time to be shy, to hold back. There is no time. I felt a strength. And that's what we've all got. I believe we've all got that. It's there. And we have to find that. And it's not an individual strength. It's a connection. It's a connection to the living world. And that's what we are. We're just creatures in this living world. And we have to start thinking. And don't be afraid of anger. And don't be afraid of anger. And I have to watch my blood pressure, but it's anger and fury that drives me. But it's also grief. And all of those negative emotions that people put aside, they come from the same place as love. And that's what Joanna Macy, who's a wonderful 90-something-year-old American woman, talks about. They come from the same place. Embrace, they're to be embraced as well.
It's interesting that she sees the most effective thing as being the one that's almost the least direct.
Yes, that's right. Exactly. It is interesting. And it is often, you know, if we were to compare, say, 35,000 people walking down the hall, walking down the main street of Dunedin, complaining about or protesting about a hospital build or unbuilt, whichever way you want to view it, versus somebody forging a letter to send around to conference delegates saying that it's been cancelled, which I personally, for myself, I think is quite clever and very witty. But as she points out, that, you know, the law doesn't have a sense of humour about these things. It did. It got a lot of bang for a buck. It got a lot of attention. And I think the reason it got a lot of attention is because it was very clever, you know. And there was, I think there's an element of it that the cheeky New Zealander can relate to and understand, which maybe is not the case if somebody's handcuffed themselves to a train or concreted themselves to a motorway. I think there's a level of, like, sort of wit and intelligence in it that I think people could really resonate with.
There's also something about the target, that if you're concreting yourself to a motorway, the people who might be encumbered by that might be trying to get to the hospital for heart surgery, whereas the people who, even if you did cancel flights or whatever and be disadvantaged by the letter cancelling the conference, you're the direct targets of that.
Yeah, I think also it's quite hard to have sympathy for petrochemical executives not going to a conference in Queenstown. I think sort of at their base level, it's something that, you know, for myself, I'm quite happy for them to be inconvenienced, if I was to be honest about it.
We talked last week about the tension between hospitality and this necessary inconvenience, and that that's kind of one of the reasons for doing all this work, is how do you actually position? The job is to feed people in the most welcoming and efficient, effective way, but also to make a change.
Yeah, and I think, look, one of the best examples of that is the stuff I'm working on with the students at the moment, was if you... So the halls of residence in both the university and Otago Polytechnic introduced this meat-free Mondays, which is something that's being championed by Paul McCartney. I think it was started by his wife. Whereas one day a week we remove all meat. And now, as a lecturer, I can tell you what it takes to engage a student. Now, the Otago Polytechnic Halls of Residence was given a petition signed by all of the residents saying that they wanted meat-free Monday removed in its entirety. At the university, they implemented meat-free Monday, and they did the calculations on it, and they figured out that they were saving, I think it was 10, I may have been slightly off, 10 cubic tons of CO2 going into the atmosphere in that one single action. So there's high fives and fist pumps all around. We're all very proud of ourselves. Until we scratch a little bit deeper and you find out what's actually happening is the bulk of the students are going into town to have fried chicken and steak. So all you're doing is you're shifting that problem further down the road. And it highlights a couple of issues. One of them is, firstly, the role that science has within the narrative of climate change, ecological change, and the role that hospitality can play in it. So underneath all of the menus at the university was a long list of data that was showing the carbon footprint of the meals that were being put forward. So the students were able to choose the lower carbon option. But that's punitive. Nobody wants that. Nobody wants to be told you can't have something. Nobody wants to have that thrust upon them. So the paper they're working on at the moment with the students is, how do you reframe that question? How do you reframe the question so that it's not about how do we take something away from people? It's how do we give something to people? How do we create something which isn't punitive? How do you create an exchange, an environment, whether it be food or otherwise, which is of better quality, of a higher standing than it was, so that people are benefiting from it? And that's the bigger question, is the reframing of this. And I think that's the role that hospitality has to play in this wider problem.
So next week we're talking with Jan, but from talking with Kyle and Rosemary, what have we got so far that's informing those questions about reframing?
Well, what we've got so far is this, the idea and an understanding of the passion which is behind this. The reason that we have to have the Rosemaries and the Kyles in the world is because they offset the apathy of the status quo. And now, I know that sounds quite harsh, and it's quite a big statement to make, but in a lot of ways, we need that extremities. We need to have these things highlighted, or else we wouldn't know. Now, I have to put a caveat in here and be quite clear, because, you know, I'm from the left side of the political spectrum. If that was someone from the right side of the political spectrum saying that, I'd probably say, no, that's not right. You can't do that. So you have to be kind of clear within yourself, I think, of your own motivators and your own lens through which you're seeing a lot of these things. To the point of when I got to the end of all these conversations, I realized what I actually need to do is I need to go talk to a climate denier so I can get a sort of more balanced viewpoint myself.
The next series.
You wait.
Who are we going out to?
I think we'll go out for something a little bit. We'll lift the mood a little bit on this one. So we're going to go for Orange Blossom. Orange Blossom are a world beat band. I've seen them a couple of times, actually, when they've been in New Zealand. Astonishing live band. They're from France. They've been around a few years. So this is, I think I'm going to pronounce this right, Hubby.
You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. Brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. We are broadcast every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. I've been talking with Tim Lynch, who himself was talking with Rosemary Penwarden. I'm Samuel Mann, that was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. Oh,
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.